for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for the ministry. And Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. Bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas when you come, and the books, especially the parchments. A few years ago, I was preaching a conference at Ridgecrest. And one of the men that was preaching with me was John Bisogno, who you know for a number of years until just recently served the First Baptist Church of Houston. He told a story that became to me a haunting illustration. He told of how as a young man that he attended Oklahoma Baptist University and he fell in love with a girl there and that he married. His new father-in-law was a pastor. And his father-in-law said to him, John, you need to really guard your spiritual life because not one in 20 young men like yourself will make it to the end in ministry. And by make it to the end, he meant that not one in 20 will not end somehow in ruin, in failure in their ministry, or they will give up because of disillusionment or discouragement. And John said that he really didn't believe that. And so he took and wrote 24 names in the flyleaf of his Bible. Of young men that were like him at the time. They were had an obsession to serve Christ. They had a passion, a sense of calling. They were on fire for the Lord. And he said, one by one, he has scratched off their names because of moral failure, because of disillusionment, cynicism. And as a man of 60, about the time that I heard him relate this story, he said, there are only three names left in the flyleaf of my Bible. Now, that was shocking to me. I don't know why it's shocking, because the fact is beginners are a dime a dozen. Terminators are rare. We are good at starting things, but not at finishing. If you don't believe that, then when you go home, look in your garage if you have one. I mean, most of our garages are filled with projects that we started, but we never quite finished. Our culture puts a premium on starting, but not on finishing. And the saddest illustration culturally of that is marriages. That we start marriages, but somehow we don't finish them. There's a jewelry store in Hollywood that has a sign in the front window that says, we rent wedding rings. Now that's sad. That's a sad indictment against our culture. But even in our in evangelical world, the emphasis today is on the initial step of Christianity. We ask questions about how many accepted Christ, how many walked down the aisle, how many were baptized. We present the gospel of a good start, but the fact is, not all who start well will finish well. This passage in 2 Timothy is about finishing well. Now, we know the context of it. The Apostle Paul is nearing the end of his life. He is now in prison. He's not in prison in the sense of before. He is not under house arrest. He is in a dark, dank dungeon that was just a hole in the ground, nicknamed the Sepulchre. He is under the sentence of death, waiting any day for the executioner to come. And so he writes his young friend Timothy, and he seeks to motivate Timothy to persevere in the ministry. And it's as if in this book he pulls out all of the stops and he uses one metaphor after another about ministry. He tells Timothy he is to be a steward, that the gospel is like a treasure that he guards, that he is to be a good soldier and fight the battle. He is to be an athlete that strives for victory. He is to be a husbandman that labors in the Lord's vineyard. He is to be a student and give himself to a life of study. He is to be a servant of the Lord. But not only does he seek to motivate Timothy with his words, but also with his own life. He becomes retrospective as he looks back over the landscape of his own life. He becomes prospective as he looks beyond his own death to the crown that is waiting him. Now, by the world's standards, Paul's life was a dismal failure. As a young man, he had thrown away position and the prospects of a bright future. He had jettisoned the prestige of being a renowned rabbi. By his own testimony, he said he had often been beaten. He had labored to the point of exhaustion. He had been hunted, despised. He had been held in derision. And now he's in prison awaiting execution. In verse 6, he gives us two images, one of pouring out and one of packing up. He says, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. The first is a reference to the libation offering. The pagans of his day would pour wine upon the sacrifice to their pagan gods. The Jews poured the wine as an offering alongside the sacrifice. And maybe the Apostle Paul is thinking of the violent nature of his own impending death. He is to be beheaded. They will take a man in that kind of execution and hold him down, struggling, and raise the two-bladed axe and sever his head, and his body will be limp and trembling, spraying blood everywhere. And maybe that's what he's referring to, of the being poured out. Or maybe he is speaking about his whole life has been like a libation offering, being poured out in a sacrifice to God. And then he says, the time of my departure is at hand. It's analusis. It's the very first verb that you learn in baby Greek, luo, to loose, to loose the moorings of a ship and to set it adrift, or to pull up the stakes of a tent. And he said, the time of my loosing, the time of my departure is at hand. The time, literally the season. In the spring of life, he met the Lord on the road to Damascus. He had that long summer run of ministry. In the fall of life, he is in prison, and now he is facing the winter of his execution. He says, I am being poured out, and I am packing up. These are the valedictory words of the... to the Apostle Paul, the benediction of a life well lived. He turns from exhorting Timothy with his words to pondering his own death. And in this reminiscing, he gives us a description of his life, and he shows us how he was enabled to finish well and how we can also finish well. It's a message that may be needed even on a seminary campus. You're in the spring of life. You're in the spring of your ministry, but you have to realize that the landscape ahead of you will be littered with broken lives. It will be littered with those whose ministries someday lie in ruins, people that have great talent, enormous abilities, great gifts, and a tremendous passion for the Lord, but for various reasons, their ministry will be will disgrace the name of the one that they love. There may be personal application. You may be pushing towards the finish line academically, or of your education. You may have managed to squeeze 3 years of seminary into 7 years, and you're coming towards the end now, and you can see the finish line ahead of you. Well, this is about how to finish well in life. First of all, the Apostle Paul shows us that in order to finish well, we must fight for the faith. In verse number 7, he says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. He gives us two illustrations, and then he gives us the greater reality. Now, don't read this in a braggadocious way. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. The emphasis is not on the pronoun. It's not on the Apostle Paul. In fact, you could translate it, fight 'tis fought, race 'tis run. We look at the Apostle Paul, and we see his life, and he becomes the model for us. And we say, he was spiritually tough. He's an old man at this point, and he's weathered the storms of life, and he's like spiritual leather, and he's tough. And we say, that's what I want to be. I want that product. But the Apostle Paul, in this verse, is not talking about the product of spiritual maturity. He is talking about the process. That the nature of ministry is, he said, it's like a fight. It is like a race. The nature of the Christian life is not an invitation to prosperity. It is not an invitation to a life that is free from adversity or free from pain. He said, and the nature of the Christian life is it is a fight. And it is the word agon. We get our word agony from it. It is an athletic word. He is saying, you have got to be tough to finish, because ministry on occasion is a battle. There is a battle going on in all of our lives, a struggle against Satan, first of all. But that's not all. There is the battle against self. It is the Apostle Paul that said, that which I want to do, I don't do, and that which I don't want to do, I end up doing. And then there is the constant struggle against culture. The Apostle Paul lived virtually all of his life out of step with his culture. And if you are to serve God in the day in which we live, there will be a constant tension within your life that you are swimming upstream, that you are out of step with the culture in which we live. And then, in ministry, there is no end to the line of people that will try to talk you out of doing what you know that you should do.
He said it is a fight, but the second illustration, he said it is a race. The Apostle Paul is like a marathon runner. He is on the 26th mile. He is nearing the finish line. He is straining every muscle. Legs are aching. Side is burning. Lungs are heaving. And yet he is nearing the finish line. And he is saying to young Timothy, do not quit the race. It is a fight and it is a race. Who can forget the Barcelona Olympics and the story of Derek Redmond, that British runner that entered the 400 meters. He felt like he'd been robbed 4 years before in the Olympics when 90 seconds before the race, he had to drop out of the race because of an injury. And so for 4 years, it became the obsession of his life to go for the gold in the Olympics. And he thought about it day and night. He must have dreamed about it. And finally, the day of the race came for Derek Redmond. He said he was in the best shape of his life. He felt better than he'd ever felt. And he started off in the race, and about halfway, at about 200 meters, his right hamstring popped, and he fell to the ground. And you may remember, I was sitting in my living room watching the race, and they panned in on his face, the camera did, and you could see this look of pain and of anguish as he watched the runners pull away from him, finishing the race. And then he struggled to his feet. And staying in his lane, he began to hobble towards the finish line. And you remember his dad crawled out of the stands, and the guards grabbed his dad, and he pushed them aside, and he went to his son's side, and then the track officials came, and he pushed them aside, and he put his arm around his boy, and as the world cheered, they hobbled towards the finish line, determined to finish the race. That's the Apostle Paul. He has been beaten, he has been stoned, he has been held in derision, and now he is hobbling towards the finish line, determined that he will finish the race. You see, ministry is not about how fast you run. It's not about how big your ministry is. At some point in life, it always becomes about perseverance, about an unwillingness to give up, because sometimes you're going to have to go where the band doesn't play. You're going to have to go where there are no accolades. You're going to have to go to where those that you invest the most in sometimes betray you. And you have to have this determination that you will fight the fight, that you will finish the race. But those are simply illustrations. Now he gives the reality. He says, I have kept the faith. He says, I have guarded it as a sacred deposit. Life has been full of voices urging me to give up the faith. There's been the bribes and the threats of the old nature and the constant whispers of the world. But as I finish my life, I tell you, I have kept the faith. Not just in a personal subjective sense that he still believes, but the faith in an objective sense, in the sense of that set of doctrine that was handed to him, the substance of the message. Now, what if Paul had not kept the faith? What if he had not written the... your own works? What if he had not written the church at Corinth that denied the resurrection of the body, or the people at Thessalonica and saying to them, no, Jesus has not come back yet, but he will in fact return again? If he had not kept the faith, maybe there would be no faith to keep. You see, every generation, we are just one generation away from the faith being extinct. And now, you and I have been handed the faith. It is as if we're in this great relay race and the baton has been handed to us. Be careful, don't drop it. Be careful, guard it as a sacred treasure, that someday at the end of your life, with great care, you can hand it to the next generation and you can say, I have fought the fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith that was handed to me as a sacred treasure. In order to finish well, we must fight for the faith. But then also, the Apostle Paul is saying to us, in order to finish well, we must focus on the future. Look in verse number 8. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but to also to all who have loved his appearing. He said there is a crown. Now, this is not the emblem of a king. It's the emblem of a victor. In those days, athletically, the most prized possession was the laurel wreath that you won at the end of the race. And it was always placed in a prominent place. Let's say that you were running in a marathon through the streets of Rome. You would finally, on that last part of the race, enter the great Colosseum. And there would be tier after tier of cheering people as you entered through the gates of the Colosseum. And in a very prominent place, at the end of the track, was the victor's crown. And all of a sudden, those aching legs and burning lungs would not matter anymore. You focused upon the crown that was before you. The Apostle Paul is saying to young Timothy, I am nearing the finish line. I have entered the stadium. I am close enough that I now see the victor's crown. We get confused sometimes and we think the reward is now. We think the reward is at mile one. It is not. The crown is not even at mile 10. The crown is not at mile 15. It's not even at mile 20. The victor's crown is at the end of the race. And the Apostle Paul is saying to Timothy, don't get bogged down in the pettiness of the race. Don't get bogged down in the struggle of the fight. Understand that your focus must be on the future, that there is, in fact, a crown awaiting for you at the end of the race. In order to finish well, we need to focus on the future. In order to finish well, we need the fellowship of friends. In the end of verse 8, he says that this crown is not for me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. And his mind goes to those that surround him. He said, be diligent to come to me quickly, for Demas has forsaken me, having loved the present world. Departed for Thessalonica, Cretans for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him, and Tychicus and I've sent to Ephesus. He says to Timothy, come quickly. It's our word that we get tachometer, come with velocity. It is the picture of an old man that is lonely. He's in a dark, dank dungeon. He is cold. He's wanting his cloak. He's wanting his books. Sadly, he says, Demas has forsaken me. These others I have sent out, Tychicus to carry the letter to the church at Ephesus, others on mission trips. Only Luke is with me. And he said, come. You will not finish well if you try to go it alone. We need one another. The Apostle Paul always had this entourage of people around him. You say, oh, well, he was discipling Timothy and he was discipling Titus. Yes, he was imparting to them, but he was receiving something from them also. There was mutual support. There was fellowship. You see, God has designed us in such a way, as believers, we need one another. We need to serve God in the gathering that we call the church. We all know, we say, how strong we are together and how weak we are apart. Everyone knows that except preachers. And we somehow think that we can be the Lone Ranger. We somehow think that we can go it alone somehow. Because after a while in ministry, you get hurt. And you maybe feel betrayed by someone that you invested in. And the fact is, the church is filled with people of imperfection. There are those that are weak. There are those that are immature. Not to mention those that are hypocritical. Someone has said to be on high with saints above, that's glory. But to be here below with saints I know, that's another story. But in spite of the hurts, in spite of the irritations and the differences we have one with another, we will not make it to the end alone. Even as a leader, you need the fellowship of a kindred spirit. You need someone in your life that you get permission to snoop around and to hold you accountable, that you're open and honest with within your life. We need the fellowship of friends. But then the last principle that he gives us, in order to finish well, we need to forget the failures of others. Look what he says in verse 11, amazingly. He said, only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for the ministry. Now, you know the story of when the Apostle Paul was living in Antioch, and there's born within his heart this great dream of the missionary enterprise. And he was thrust out into that great work with Barnabas. And they took a young man with them by the name of John Mark. And somewhere along the way, John Mark quit. I don't know if he got sick. I don't know if he was homesick. I don't know if it was the persecution, but he turned back. It was sometime later when they got ready to go on the next missionary trip that Barnabas says, let's give Mark another chance. And Paul says, no way. He's a quitter. He turned back. And the contention broke up the dynamic duo. You know, they went their separate ways. But now, weeks have went by, months. The months have turned into years, the years into decades. Apostle Paul has long past forgiven Mark, and he has forgotten it, and he's the hurt of that experience, and he says, you bring Mark with you. There are some people, some pastors, in fact, that no slight ever escapes them. No injury is ever forgotten. They tuck within the folds of their heart this long list of those who have wronged them. If you want in the ministry an absolute agenda for misery, then you try to settle every score. Bitterness will grow in your heart. You'll develop a critical and a cynical spirit. It will poison your prayer life. It will ruin your home life. It will wreck your ministry, not to mention what it'll do for your own private spiritual life. If the nature of ministry is a fight, then expect to get hurt. If it is a race, then expect to be bumped within the race. In the LA Olympics, Mary Decker was said to be a lock on the 800-meter race. She held the world record in that. And I remember watching that race. She started off strong, as she always did. As they rounded the first curve, the girl from South Africa bumped her. She lost her balance, and she fell. The camera zoomed in on her, and you could see the ambition of winning that race just drained from her face. And she literally sat on the track and began to cry. Compare that to Eric Little, that was enshrined in the movie years ago of Chariots of Fire, that went on to become the great Presbyterian missionary that was martyred for Christ in China. In that movie, there is that scene where he is bumped in a race, and he falls. And you can see in the camera in his face maybe the flicker of temptation that he's going to just sit there. But he doesn't. He gets up. And in an orthodox style, his arms begin to flay as he runs, and his head heavenward. And he runs with all of his might. And not only does he finish the race, but he wins the race. You see, in life, you're going to get knocked down. You're going to be hurt. It is a fight. It is a race. And there's going to be the hurts in life. There has to be a determination to forget the failures of others around about you. Let go of life's hurts. I remember years ago now, when our first child was born, a little girl, she reminded me of my sister's Chatty Cathy doll when I was growing up, because she had blonde hair and blue eyes, and I thought newborn babies were, you know, about as pretty as newborn mice until we had ours. She was beautiful. We named her Charity, which of course means love. As a little thing, she was so full of love. I remember when she was in first grade, it was the night for her open house, and she was so excited that we would be able to come and meet her teacher and see the little things that she had done in the classroom and so forth. And I was preaching a revival meeting at that time across town, and so I explained to her at the supper table that I said, Daddy has to be preaching tonight. I would love to go to your open house. Your mom's going to go, but I'm going to be across town telling people about Jesus. She said, oh, that's okay, Daddy. You need to do that. As I was preaching that night, I came to the end of the service, and during the invitation, there was a phone that rang in the back of the little church building. And in a few moments, there was an usher that came out of the room having answered the phone, and he began to wave frantically at me. Well, I was finishing the invitation, turned it over to the pastor, went and took the phone call. A voice on the other end said, your little girl, Charity, has been hit by a car. In my mind, I envisioned her maybe being bumped in the parking lot there at the school and maybe bruised or scratched. And they said that they were taking her to a hospital. And so I rushed to the hospital. I actually got there before the ambulance did. And then they unloaded my little Charity. And she was dead. She had been struck on the side of the road holding hands with her little brother, who was 4 at the time, that is now 20 and is going into the ministry, Matthew. She had been hit by a lady inexplicably, driving recklessly among children, hit and run. The lady didn't even stop. It was 2 days later that there was a knock on my door early in the morning, and I opened the door, and there was a young woman there, and she told me that she was the one that had killed my little girl. And then she said to me, will you forgive me? And under my breath, I said,
to the Lord, give me grace. And I said, yes, I forgive you. And I have not held one moment of malice towards that young woman. But now I realize some things I didn't realize then. I realize that if I had not said, yes, I forgive you, that someone, somewhere, would have scratched my name off of a list. Because you cannot finish well if you hold on to life's hurts and injustices that will surely come. In order to finish well, we must fight for the faith. We need to focus on the future. We need the fellowship of friends, and we need to forget the failures of others. It was perhaps a few days later, after Paul finished penning this letter, maybe weeks, maybe months, that the soldiers came for the apostle. They pulled him out of that hole in the ground. He probably covered his eyes as he squinted at the sun that he had not seen for some time. A burly soldier grabbed him and led him to the south side of the city of Rome. He said a few words, I'm sure, to Luke, and perhaps Timothy and Mark were there by then. We don't know. He laid down upon that chopping block. The soldier lifted the two-bladed axe. And perhaps the Apostle Paul, out of the corner of his eyes, thought he saw the glint of the sun off the axe. And then, no, in the next moment he realized it was really the sheen on Jesus' face as he said to him, well done, thou good and faithful servant, because Paul had finished well. God help us to do likewise.